There are two ways to win elections in Singapore. You can, of course, win the old-fashioned way, by receiving more votes than your opponent. Alternatively, you can also win by receiving fewer votes. That's exactly what happened, in fact, just 2 weeks ago, when the Workers' Party won a seat in Parliament despite losing 47% to the ruling party's 52% in the Tampines constituency. Now, in many countries, a party that wins, say, a third of the vote receives a third of all seats in Parliament. But this is not that. Voters in Singapore are told to pick a single candidate. The one who receives the most votes, even just by one vote, wins that entire district, like the United States. But then, their opponent, who may have received just 15% of the vote, is also offered a seat in Parliament, despite being overwhelmingly rejected by voters. The only thing stranger than letting the losers of an election win is who came up with this idea, the winners. When the People's Action Party created this system in 1984, it held 97% of all seats in Parliament. This was not an insurance policy in case one of its own candidates lost an election. The lowest share of seats it has ever held in the country's history is 89%. And it specifically wrote the law to benefit its competitors, not itself. The way it works is by setting a minimum number of opposition members of parliament, originally 3, now 12. Meaning, if voters only elect, say, 5 candidates who are not members of the ruling PAP, the government then offers extra seats to 7 of its adversaries. 7 members of the opposition who came closest to winning, the quote, best losers. In other words, Singapore's ruling party, one, I should add, notorious for its authoritarian tendencies, used its absolute unchecked power to manipulate the outcome of elections in its opponent's favor, guaranteeing that no matter how Singaporeans voted, the opposition would always get elected. And it did this completely voluntarily, without public pressure. In fact, the opposition rebelled against it, refusing the free parliament seats offered to them in the next election. The real purpose of this scheme, they argued, was to create the appearance of democracy where there was none. Ironically, by doing something deeply undemocratic, asking voters to choose their representatives only to then elect those they rejected. In the 4 elections prior to 1984, the PAP won every seat in Parliament, a margin of victory one expects from North Korea, not a true democracy. By guaranteeing the presence of an opposition, the PAP could avoid this embarrassment. Crucially, it could reap these rewards without actually giving the opposition any real power. Even if all 12 opposition members vote together, they don't stand a chance against the PAP's 89% majority. Plus, the genius of electing them this way is that it entraps the opposition. If they accuse the PAP of being undemocratic, the PAP can turn this accusation back on them. By accepting the seats given to them undemocratically, the opposition is implicated too. Finally, opposition parties believe they're set up to fail once elected. These best losers are called Non-Constituency Members of Parliament, NCMPs. Unlike regular members of parliament, they don't actually represent any district. That makes it difficult for them to build rapport with voters, hold events, or advocate on the community's behalf. And they're paid just $22,000 a year, nearly 7 times less than regular members. If the PAP were serious about including the opposition, they argue, it could simply allow them to win elections the normal way by leveling the playing field. Unlike Russia or Myanmar, elections in Singapore are never fraudulent, Votes are always counted accurately, but that doesn't make them fair. Districts, for example, are redrawn just months or even weeks before elections, meaning candidates don't know which voters they'll be courting until the very last minute. U.S. presidential campaigns last years. Campaigns in Singapore last exactly 9 days, by law. This gives the opposition just over 1 week every 5 years to convince voters. The ruling party, by contrast, effectively has every day. This is made worse by the blurred lines between the People's Action Party and the government of Singapore. Voters, after all, have never known their country without it. It's no coincidence that the party won its highest share of the vote since 2001 during the country's 50th anniversary, and shortly after the death of its celebrated founder, Lee Kuan Yew. The government also uses the threat of costly lawsuits to deter criticism. The PAP, meanwhile, would say electing NCMPs is in fact more democratic. Take that 2015 election, for example. The Workers' Party came in second place with 12.8% of the total vote. Yet, it only would have won 6.7% of seats in parliament. But because three of their best losers were offered NCMP positions, their share of seats increased to 9.7%. In other words, its representation in government became much closer to the share of votes it received, closer to the collective will of the people. It also argues opposition members help keep the PAP in check, by sharpening its debating skills and ensuring there's always someone outside the party to investigate accusations made against it. Finally, they point to the opportunities NCMP seats offer the opposition. By attending, speaking at, and voting in parliament, politicians can develop their skills, become familiar with government, and leverage this publicity in future elections, even if they can't block legislation. But there's another, more cynical reason the PAP may want to elect its opposition. When Singaporeans are asked, in secret, by independent researchers, roughly 70 to 80% say they approve of and have confidence in the ruling party. And not without reason. As the PAP is fond of saying, it took Singapore from third world to first. In the 1960s, its GDP per capita was barely higher than its neighbor, Malaysia. Today, it's a miraculous $84,000 a year. And in that time, it created some of the world's best public housing, healthcare, transit, and education systems. Strangely, however, this is not entirely reflected at the ballot box. Those 70 to 80% of Singaporeans who say they're satisfied with the PAP do vote. All citizens are required to. Yet, many of them don't vote for the PAP. It hasn't won 80% of the vote in nearly 60 years. In 2011, it barely won 60%. This gap between what voters think and how they vote is widely interpreted to mean that although much of the public is satisfied with the party, they're also scared it will get complacent. In other words, because the PAP wins every election anyway, the public can safely vote for the opposition to send the PAP a message without risking a true change of leadership. They want the PAP to stay in power, but they also want them to feel pressure, to be responsive to their concerns. And there are concerns about inequality, rising housing prices, and immigration, to name just a few. The PAP had this realization back in 1981, the first time since independence one of its candidates lost an election. Suddenly faced with the tiniest bit of competition, the PAP grew concerned about what it calls a freak election, one in which Singaporeans collectively remove the PAP even though each individual voter only intends to send it a message. 3 years later, it created non-constituency members of parliament. This was the PAP's way of replying to the message voters were sending, If they wanted to keep the PAP in charge but introduce some more opposition, they could now have their cake and eat it too. By guaranteeing a minimum number of opposition seats, voters could stop voting for the opposition, reducing the risk of a freak election, and still get the benefit of more ideological diversity. But the ruling party underestimated voters and the opposition. The former don't want to be told how to vote, and they won't settle for an artificial PAP-appointed opposition. Over the 40 years since NCMPs were introduced, the PAP's dominance has slowly eroded. It still wins, to be clear, by margins most parties around the world could only dream of. Still, the trend is clear. The opposition is making gains, albeit very slowly. The PAP has responded by increasing the number of NCMPs, from 3 to 9, and then from 9 to 12. It seems to be saying, however much opposition you want, we'll give it to you, but please keep voting for us. Ironically, each time it does this, its share of the vote has subsequently gone down. Voters, it seems, want real competition and see NCMPs as little more than a distraction. Opposition parties, likewise, have fought back. For obvious reasons, they don't want the terms of the competition set by their opponents. In their eyes, the PAP first stacked the deck against them with gerrymandering, short campaign periods, and the threat of lawsuits. Then it removed one of their few remaining weapons, the power of being an underdog. The opposition campaigns on being the David to the PAP's Goliath, accepting free seats in parliament granted to them by a benevolent ruling party undermines that perception. They don't want to win by losing. They want to win by winning. So they did something clever. In the 1991 election, the opposition decided to only compete for 49% of all seats, guaranteeing the PAP would stay in power even if every last member of the opposition won their race. This meant that voters could once again safely vote for the opposition, knowing the PAP would stay in power. Later, in 2011, members of the Workers' Party and Singapore Democratic Party promised to decline any NCMP seats offered to them, cleverly forcing Singaporeans to vote for them if they wanted to see any opposition representation in parliament. Such is the strange state of politics in Singapore. The ruling party tries to give its opposition power, while the opposition has at times refused the power given to it, and even tried not to win elections. The PAP prevents the opposition from gaining power by giving it power. The opposition attempts to gain power by refusing it. And this is far from the only quirk of its political system. Originally, voters in each district elected a single representative. Then, in 1988, the government designated some districts as Group Representation Constituencies, GRCs, where voters would choose from a set of 3 to 6 candidates from a single party, all of which would then be elected. At least one member of each group must be Malay, Indian, or another ethnic minority. The PAP saw this as a way to increase the diversity of parliament without encouraging Malays to vote for fellow Malays or Indians to vote for fellow Indians. The minority requirement increases their representation in government, while electing candidates in sets prevents them from being pitted against one another directly, reducing ethnic strife. Opposition parties, on the other hand, see this as a devious pretext to solidify the PAP's electoral advantage. GRCs require more candidates and more resources, which benefits the large and powerful ruling party. Finally, the office of the president was changed dramatically in 1991. Previously, the president was largely a ceremonial figure, as in other parliamentary systems like Germany and India. Today, the president of Singapore is directly elected and acts as a check against parliament. While it's still not nearly as powerful as, say, the American presidency, he or she does hold veto power over a few key decisions with especially long-term implications, like spending the country's reserves. The goal of these reforms, the PAP said, was to protect against a freak election. If voters did elect an opposition government, who they imply would be grossly incompetent, the president might be able to stop them from destroying Singapore, or at least minimize the damage. The opposition, meanwhile, says it supports more checks and balances, but only when those checks apply equally to all parties. The legal criteria for becoming president are extremely narrow. Not just the usual things like citizenship and age, but also that they've served at least 3 years as a government official, senior executive of a local company worth at least $500 million, or quote, any other similar position. In one report from 2005, it was estimated that just 400 people on Earth met these strict requirements. And the vast majority are likely to be supporters of, or at least sympathetic to, the PAP establishment. The presidency, they argue, was designed to be maximally constraining to a hypothetical opposition government, while being minimally disruptive to a PAP government. With each of these reforms, NCMPs, GRCs, and the elected presidency, Singapore has become more and more of a strange outlier. Once very similar to the first-past-the-post parliamentary system it inherited from the British during colonial times, today Singapore defies both democratic and autocratic norms. The question is, what, then, does that make it? Is Singapore a flawed democracy, very slowly inching toward more competitive elections only thanks to pressure applied by voters, which the ruling party tries to resist? Or is Singapore a more advanced, more perfected form of democracy? One that balances the stability of one-party rule with the checks and balances of elections, allowing it to govern more effectively than pure authoritarian governments like China, and less chaotically than pure democracies like India. The answer depends on how exactly you define democracy. The PAP argues competitive elections are a frequent side effect, though not an essential feature, of democracy. If one party is truly and persistently better at governing, as judged by voters, then there's nothing in principle undemocratic about the same party winning every election for 60 years. Most parties around the world, they would argue, are just incompetent, or at least equally competent, which is why voters go back and forth. Besides, the ruling party, it would say, need not actually lose power for elections to work effectively. While the PAP may not seriously worry about being voted out of office, we also know that it does take elections quite seriously, and is responsive to even minor fluctuations in its share of the vote. After the PAP won a shockingly low 60.1% of the vote in 2011, for example, it very uncharacteristically apologized to the public, Lee Kuan Yew resigned from government, and major policy changes were made. Is that not democracy at work, the PAP would ask? Opponents counter that the hypothetical threat of losing power in a quote freak election is not enough. Every government, even Xi's China or Putin's Russia, after all, is at least somewhat responsive to the public, if only out of fear. The PAP will adjust its policies to improve its mandate and win popularity, sure, but only so much. The party, not voters, they would say, are in the driver's seat, which means the latter are ultimately at the mercy of whoever's in power. Even if a majority of voters do want the PAP to rule Singapore today, there may come a day when that's no longer true. When that happens, the party may respond not by fighting harder for their vote, but by effectively stealing it, further stacking the deck in its favor. We know this, the opposition would say, because it's already done so, first with NCMPs, next with GRCs, and then the elected presidency. In the grand scheme of election trickery, all three reforms were relatively minor. But then again, so were the opposition gains that inspired them, Non-constituency members of parliament, recall, were created after the opposition won just 1 out of 75 seats. If that was its response to a 1% opposition presence in parliament, just imagine how it might respond to the possibility of 51%. 50 years ago, as China began shaking off Mao's extremism and charting a new course for the country's future, the Communist Party looked to Singapore as a potential model. Perhaps it thought it could follow in the PAP's footsteps, introducing some democratic reforms without giving up any real power. Instead, China decided to go its own way, loosening up economically, though not politically. And it may turn out that Singapore follows in China's footsteps, ratcheting up the repression and yet remaining in power by tilting the scales in its favor. To remind itself of how terribly that could end, the PAP should keep in mind the atrocities made possible by this excessive hubris. And there's perhaps no more powerful example of this than the one-child policy. The Chinese Communist Party, much like the PAP, believed itself to be almost godlike, imagining it could engineer humans as though they were machines. In reality, the policy was not nearly as effective as it assumed. Experts now believe it had a shockingly small effect on China's actual population size, despite inflicting unfathomable suffering. I made a whole video explaining why it didn't work, along with 6 other episodes of my original series China Actually, exclusively available right now on today's sponsor, Nebula. Nebula is the streaming platform myself and many of your favorite channels created as a home for more premium, high-budget, and thoughtful projects. Projects like Real Life Lore's Modern Conflict series, 30, 40, 50-minute deep dives on some of history's most fascinating chapters, like Russia's invasion of Ukraine and the manhunt for El Chapo. Projects like Abolish Everything, a fast-paced and frankly hilarious comedy debate show in which comedians argue for the abolition of such things as liquid death, sunscreen, dentists, and beeps in front of a live studio audience. Projects like Jet Lag, Arctic to Africa, The Getaway, Boomers, Underexposure, The Battle of Britain, and so much more. There are no ads, many videos are available early, we have superb iOS and Android apps, and new originals are releasing all the time. You can even give your friends guest passes so they can watch along with you. Normally, Nebula costs $6 a month. But you can get it for just half that by signing up for a year with a link on screen or in the description now. That's just $3 a month to watch my original China Actually and countless more today.